On this episode of Narcissist Apocalypse, we talk with an abuse survivor named Henrietta. And Henrietta was raised by a manipulative narcissistic mother. It's a story of generational trauma, scapegoats, parental alienation, and the cult of family. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. With me today, I have Henrietta. How are you?
Alive, which is great. The absolute minimum, which is perfect for me. I'm still alive today.
I think that's the first time we've had that answer. So I'm happy you're here. We chit-chatted a little before I turned on the recorder, loosened up a little. Both of us did. I spoke to you a while ago, and I was sitting in a coffee shop during that conversation, and there was a lot of background noise while I was kind of getting the ins and outs of your story. And I don't know if you remember that at a certain point, someone started talking to me. I forget what completely happened, but
I think they were saying that, like, you shouldn't webcam because the ghost on the other
something
side
about
of the
spirits.
Screen can come
something
through.
Was about spirits. It was a really odd interaction. I'm talking to you about really serious things, and then someone starts talking to me about the spirits that might be coming through the computer.
Right. That's the wrong podcast. I'm sorry.
So I really want to thank you for being here. Today we're going to hear your story. It's a family story. It's a complicated story. And there are a lot of different things going on. So I know you're going to do a great job communicating everything that you want to communicate. And you're going to help a lot of people just by being here and just by being you. Because you're a really good person. Everyone's going to find that out today. Also, everyone, a trigger warning, we do discuss child sexual abuse in Henrietta's story. And now, without further ado, Henrietta, the floor is now yours.
Thank you so much. So my family are Vietnamese immigrants from post-war. And they came to the States, I think in the late 80s, and they were teenagers at the time and they weren't married yet. But it's so bananas. My entire family line is just full of narcissists. It's, so my mom is one, but she married my dad to get away from her narcissistic mother. It was definitely one of those weddings where it was like, I need to get away from my mom. So she married my dad. They moved into the northern states of the U.S., where my mom's family lived in the southern states of the U.S. And so my mom was, up north. She didn't have her family around. She didn't have any friends because they're pretty new to America, so they didn't have a lot of friends or anything. And at the time that they got married, my dad was like, you don't have to work, I'll take care of you, you don't need a license, I'll drive you around, basically his way of being her knight in shining armor. But the ulterior motive was that, like, she can't go anywhere without him. She can't do anything without him. And because of that, my mom was very isolated, very trapped. And my dad's family already hated her from the beginning. So when they had the three daughters, us three, we ended up being, like, byproducts of that hate as well. And so There are so many siblings. I'm just going to name us by numbers. My older sister is number one. I'm number two. And at the time, it was just my younger sister as well, number three. So it was the three of us for about 13-ish years. And so I was not only the middle child, which, like, if anyone's into, like, the whole psychology thing, like, the middle child tends to get the shittiest end of the stick. And not only was I the middle child, I was also the scapegoat of the family. And I also was bullied a lot, not just in school, but also, you know, by my dad's family and all that stuff, too. So I didn't have friends, and I barely had, like, family other than my mom and my sisters. And my dad, he was around, but he was very emotionally unavailable. Like, I don't know if it's an Asian thing or if it's just how my dad is, but, like, he was just like, I put food on the table, I pay the bills, you know, like, and so my mom was, like, our primary caregiver. And because she didn't have a job or anything else, you know, like, she dedicated all of her time to us. And so, like, my mom was, like, our safe haven. And my sisters were, like, my only comrades and the people I trust. And, like, it's, I can't say that I hate my mom. I don't think to this day I can say that I hate my mom, because I do think that, at least in the beginning, she had very genuine intentions of trying to be a mom and care for us and love us. And then it just turned into something, I guess, more manipulative down the line. But
so when we talk about your family story, your parents' parents, their parents, this is a story of generational trauma.
Yeah.
And in many ways, sometimes you think that the person that you're trusting is the person being abused, which they can be abused, but we don't necessarily see the whole them. And a lot of times in generational trauma, you have the people that are just passing it along from generation to generation. And then there are people like you who are saying, it's stopping here with me. And your mom might be in one aspect, one thing, and then in which is a victim. And then in another aspect, they can be the abuser. And you might see your dad in one way, in one instance, and see him in a bad light maybe originally. And then that might change depending on certain things. And these are the confusing things, because if you've listened to some older episodes, and maybe I'm saying older episodes, maybe I'm not sure, because things everyone meld into stories. Sometimes stories meld together and I forget who's who and what is what. And maybe if I even put these episodes out there, but there have been many instances and stories that I've heard where the parent that they thought was the safe parent after a divorce happens, they thought this one parent was the abused parent, and they were. But when the divorce happened after the fact, we find out that, okay, they are also an abuser. Look at how they're acting now towards me. Before, it part kind of fit into their persona of being a victim. So actually being a victim of abuse sometimes for a specific type of person fits, because they can play it and it's true and it's real and everyone can see it. But when you take that abuser out of the situation and there's no one doing that to them, all of a sudden that person needs this specific drama or needs to be the victim of something, and all of a sudden they're making an abuser or someone terrible when they're not, that person isn't terrible, into someone terrible, and all of a sudden you realize, hold on one second, what's going on here? And so I've heard that story so many times, and not that I've jumped the gun here. We still have to find out about all of the roles of every single family member here.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting thing for people to... It's a world-shattering thing for a lot of people.
Right.
Because you lived in a world where this person is this thing, and then all of a sudden you're like, what? What? I don't... It's hard to compute.
Mm-hmm.
So I went off on a tangent there. I apologize.
It's okay. No, it makes sense. Yeah, the entire psychology of it all. Victims can also turn into abusers themselves. And it's a toxic cycle. And people either continue that cycle or they break it. And my mom says that she is breaking it, but is continuing it. And I guess when we're on the topic of the roles, family roles, number one was actually the golden child.
Your oldest sister.
The older sister, yes, yes. I'm number two, and I was the scapegoat. And my younger sister, number three, was actually the invisible child of all of us. And number one and I were only like 13 months apart. So like we're very close in age, and like immediately there's like competition with us academically, because like we didn't have, you know, friends or really like family to play with or, you know, be involved with. So we only had each other, and it's hard enough in an Asian family for you to like have that expectations of like making good grades, and then like you throw in the competition of a younger sibling, you know, and like, so my older sister would be in whatever grade in whatever class, and she would make good grades. And then when I came into that same class the year afterwards, my mom would be like, you have to do just as good, if not better, than your sister. And for me, just as good was not good enough. So I had to be better. So I studied hard, and my grades, like, I don't mean to brag, my grades were really good. You know, I didn't have my first B on my report card until I was like in ninth grade. So like I was top notch geek and nerd.
How did you feel about that B?
It was in PE, which...
So that didn't count in your opinion?
In my opinion, I don't think it counted. And honestly, if my first B is in PE, I think I'm okay with that. It just kind of goes to show the type of person I was. I was just not a physical person at all. Competitions with my older sister happened a lot, you know, with our grades and stuff. And it, our personalities were very different too. Number one, also, like she very quickly picked up a domineering personality. And it's because of her role as the oldest sister. And also like with my dad's absence in the family or whatever, my mom like really like utilized us for emotional support and all that as well. And my older sister, of course, like, you know, she bare the brunt of it because she was the oldest one. Number one always like had this air of dominance in any situation we were in. And then as we grew up, you could see that even her dominance, like, overtook my mom's as well. Like they, to this day, both of them still kind of like fight for that like authority figure in the household. And it's very, very weird and very toxic. And I was just like, I can't do this. Like, and for me, I was very shy, not anymore. I was very shy, very quiet. But I was also like quite the monkey. Like I would, you know, run around and I laugh loudly and I tried to make friends. I was like more sociable than like anyone in my family. And my mom and sister didn't like that because they said that, like, you know, you need to be a good, like, studious person. Keep your head down. You do your work. You make the good grades, you know, and show yourself academically, because whatever I did was a reflection on their appearance, you know. And
so at a very young age here, you're trying to be yourself. You're being told that being yourself is not good for the family.
Yep.
You have to represent the family the way they want to be represented. All of a sudden, your voice has been taken away from you. All these types of things along those lines, as far as autonomy has been taken away from you. You're become an extension of your mother, and you become this person in a competition with your sister about who can be the best at what they're doing. And perfectionism, I assume, here has been, you know, found its way into your bloodstream.
And
has now become a big part of who you are, because this is how you have to play the game to be seen by your parents and to be appreciated. And it's not being yourself. Not that being good at schoolwork is bad, but for that to be your identity and for your way of being, to be accepted, is what's gone wrong here.
Yeah, and it gets worse. I'm going to say that a lot in this episode, but it gets worse. Like, when I was 8, I got diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, which is cancer. It's one of the two main types of cancer that children get, the other one being leukemia, which luckily for me, I didn't have that one. But I started like getting sick a lot, and my mom, you know, eventually had to take me to the hospital, and they diagnosed me. I was put on chemo for several months. I was hospitalized, and then I went through radiation as well. And like at the time, it felt so good because my mom had to be by my side throughout all of it. And I pretty much had her undivided attention, and it just felt like, oh, this is what being loved by my mom is like. And then very soon, and I didn't realize this until like way down the line, but like pretty soon, like it just seems like she enjoyed the sympathy she was getting from people and the attention that she was getting from people, especially, you know, strangers and, you know, people who would give us stuff or be kinder to us and all that. Like, it was so, it's so weird. She put on this air of like, woe is me. And, but I'm the one who's dying. It was just, it was hard to comprehend at the time, but like at the time I was just like, oh, my mom, you know, she left my other two sisters at the house. She's with me all the time, you know? And it just felt good. I thought at the time it was genuine, but, you know, looking back now, there are a lot of moments where she used me for her own gain. And one of it being, I think I told you about this, the Make-A-Wish Foundation, where like they grant one dying wish to every cancer patient or whatever. And 90s kids, me, wanted to go to the Backstreet Boys concert because that was the thing back in the day.
Who is your favorite Backstreet Boy?
Oh my God. Okay, it's controversial now, but Brian definitely was.
Why is that controversial now?
His political views are
I have no idea about the political views. But I don't keep up on the Backstreet Boys politics.
How dare you? Yeah. I'm kidding. No, I was very sad to find out about that. But nevertheless, back in the day, my heart belonged to him and only him. don't tell my husband that.
Don't worry. Your secret is safe with me and, you know, another 10 to 20,000 people.
Oh, fun. But yeah, so homegirl, me, wanted to go to a Backstreet Boys concert. And my mom said, no, you want to go to Vietnam. And I was like, oh, she basically coerced me into using my dying wish to go to Vietnam to see people I've never met before in my life, to a country I've never been to or had no interest in going to. And like, I always thought that was like one of the core memories that really fucked me up, because I was just like, as an 8-year-old, you're just like, I just want to go see the Backstreet Boys. Why do I have to go to Vietnam? but then, like, as I got older, I just realized how messed up that was. You know, it's like, dude, your kid's dying. Like, she might not make it to the next year. And, like, your biggest concern is when you get to see your family again in Vietnam and spend time with those people. So, yeah, like, they gave us tickets for me, my sisters and my mom to go back there. And that was my first trip to Vietnam, and can't say I enjoyed it that much. I'm gonna be honest with you. The food was great. Yeah, it was just because it wasn't for me, you know. It was about my mom. It was for my mom. I was just like her way of getting there.
I want it my way.
I do. Tell me why. Tell me why. Please. You can't be throwing out like Backstreet Boy puns, because I will sing and your audience will turn off this podcast so fast. So fast. But yeah, so I don't want to say I make light of the situation, but like one of my coping mechanisms is to make light of my own situation, or else I would just like cuddle up in a dark corner and cry my eyes out until my hair goes gray. The timeline kind of bounces a little bit, because when I was 6, my uncle, my dad's youngest brother, started molesting me on a weekly basis. And that would happen and pretty much every time I went over to visit my dad's family. And, you know, we were all left to our own devices. You know, my dad was drinking and gambling with his brothers and in-laws, and all of the wives were sitting around gossiping with each other. And so all the kids were left to their own devices. And although my uncle, he was only 2 years older than me, so I think he was 8 when he started doing it, and I was like 6 at the time. And then it pretty much happened for six years, you know, almost on a weekly basis. I think like the only gap was when I was hospitalized doing chemo. So I was undergoing another traumatic life event, which is why, you know, the abuse paused for me. But so big pin in that cushion, because that's gonna come back and bite all of us in the ass. But yeah, my uncle would use like a lot of like manipulation and coercion to get me alone. And you know, he pit my cousins and sisters against me, and he would be like, if you don't let me do this, I'll tell them not to play with you anymore. And like for me as a 6-year-old, I already don't have friends. I'm already being bullied by my family and stuff like that. So like to say that like he was going to ostracize me from my sisters and cousins, like I was like desperate not to lose that as well. So.
And does anyone find out about what's going on? And if so, what happens?
That happens when I was 16.
Okay. So we'll get there. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I was 11 or 12, my dad went to Vietnam, and I think he met somebody there. And there's a lot of back and forth where people are like, he actually had an affair with her. And then like him actually just being like, it was a misunderstanding. So when he came back, you know, like my mom divorced him when she found out. She was like, I stuck with you through all this other bullshit. I'm not sticking with you for cheating on me, you know. And so she basically took all three of us, moved us down south where her family was. But like, even before the divorce was finalized, I realized that she was already talking to another man. And I found out a few years ago that like the man she was talking to and my stepdad was actually a friend of my dad's. So I was just like, oh my gosh. But like, I could tell very early on that like my mom didn't really have feelings for my stepdad. I felt like it was more for financial security and just like making sure we had a place to stay and food and all that stuff. So like, he basically was just like my mom's bank. it sucks because, you know, my stepdad, he's not, my dad and stepdad are not good husbands, at least not to my mom. But that doesn't mean they were bad people. And I feel like my mom and my sisters had a hard time rationalizing that because it was all like all good or all bad, all like good and evil. And it's like, if you wrong me, you're an evil person. And that's how she manipulated my stepdad into that. She would hit us against my dad and my stepdad, saying that, like, your dad did this to hurt us. He abandoned us. He betrayed us. So you need to, like, utilize your position as his daughters to, like, get money from him or get him to basically do our bidding whenever we wanted. You know, and so like we grew up hating our dad because it was like, oh, dad betrayed us, you know, not just mom, he betrayed all of us. And so like she got us to hate our stepmom as well. And all that stuff. So it was really bad. I didn't realize how much of a web she was creating by doing that. And, you know, so now she still doesn't have a job, still doesn't have a car, lives with my stepdad, but she now has two sources of income from both my dad and my stepdad.
So before the divorce began, before the allegations of cheating, before any of that, within the relationship of your mom and dad, what were you experiencing as an observer about the relationship in hindsight, and then also at the time, for you to come to conclusions about what's going on, or things that were being fed to you at that time to reinforce what was going on? Because during this time, you know, parental alienation of what occurs here is something everyone deals with. So as a child, how do you think you were influenced in this position even before the divorce happened? And for parents out there to learn from what you went through, what would you say to them about that?
It definitely felt like my mom swayed our perceptions of my dad long before they got divorced. Mostly like just saying like all of the things that he's done wrong and like to her, which in essence mean that like he was doing it, or he was wronging us, his daughters as well. My dad had a drinking problem. He was smoking cigarettes a lot. I think like at some point he did have like a drug habit, and all too. But like the only way I can describe it is like my dad's side of family are pretty much like all like corrupted hedonists. They just indulge, and they come first. And I can't say who they are now, but like back in the day, that's just kind of what it seemed, you know, that like you were there for them to, you had to add value to my dad's family. And I mean, even then, like with my mom too, like she learned that from them. And for me, I just think that like with divorce, you know, it's you have to be able to separate the husband aspect and the father aspect. And for me, I tell this to my friends too. It's like, hey, like so-and-so is a shitty boyfriend. Like, I don't recommend anyone like dating this person or whatever, you know, but he's not evil. Like, he's not a bad person. He's just bad in relationships. And that was my dad. But it doesn't mean that they're bad people. But, and so like, you can't use what they've wronged you and put that on that they're also a bad parent, because they might be a great parent, you know? And if you alienate your child and demonize your ex or whatever, you know, like, you are going to skew your child's perspective of their parent that didn't need to happen or is untrue. Like, I grew up, you know, I think for the next 10 years, just like thinking that like my dad was the worst human being in the world. And like, it's not like that at all. Not even to that extent, you know, like, there's just a lot of misunderstanding and lack of empathy that goes on.
So we were talking about the divorce. Everyone, we had a little bit of a technical glitch, but we're back. We were talking about the divorce. So I guess continue about kind of what happened in that little phase.
Yes. So my mom used to like dangle. She did this thing where she was like, I don't want any child support from my ex-husband. But then she would dangle us over his head to get like money or just to hold power over him. You know, it's like, my dad lost my mom. He doesn't want to lose all three of his daughters as well. So like, she would, you know, use like visitation rights or even like us talking on the phone with him, you know, as bargaining chips for, sometimes like for money, and then other times just to simply be like, I can do this. Like, I can take your kids away from you at any time. You know, it was like such a mind fuck. And we would all like grow up just thinking that like, yeah, I mean, it's fine that like we treat our dad like shit because like he treated mom like shit and he abandoned us. And then my stepdad comes into the role and he's very stoic as well. Very, emotionally unavailable, which my husband now says that like, yeah, your mom married all of these like stoic dudes so that she has enough emotion to for the both of them, you know, and for the entire family. Because like, if and I've come to realize too that like, a lot of the men in our family, if they have like dominant personalities, my mom either tries to subdue that or get rid of it. It's one of those things. It has to be, since her divorce with my dad, she became like the matriarch. Like, it was always subtly like a matriarch, but she was very like submissive with my dad. She kept her head down because she was in a place where it was out of her element. But when she's in her element, she's down south now. She has her family with her. She has, you know, this, second husband, who's going to dote on her now. And I mean, she knew how to work the game. She took her trauma. She took, everything that happened in her first marriage and, utilized it to her own advantage in her second marriage. So a few things happened along the way, such as like, Hurricane Katrina. So had to go through that. We lost everything. We had to move north of where we originally were, like about an hour. Made some new friends. Which was weird. I made friends for the first time when I moved down south. I was so surprised. They were like, "You're smart and you're kind of pretty and you're funny," and like, they enjoyed who I was, like, without like my mom or sister telling me, like, sit down and be quiet. Like, they just knew from my personality and the way I was at school and stuff. They were just like, you're a really cool person. I like you. And I'm just like, oh my God, people like me for being smart. This is great. Like, it was such a stark contrast from living up north. It's really true. People down there are a lot kinder in that way. And they're very easygoing, very heartwarming people. And I made my first friends there, and I felt like I could, like, finally be myself. But, like, I was still held on a pretty tight leash by, like, if my mom wasn't there, then my older sister was there to hold the leash. So there was only so much that I could act out, quote unquote. But my grades still stayed great. And, it started out as, like, my grades, good grades being, like, my mom praising me for it, you know, it's like, oh, you did so well. And then it just turned into expectations. And it got to the point where, like, my good grades was my default. Like, anything less than that is unacceptable. Whereas number one and number three, the bar for them was a lot lower. They got lauded. My mom celebrated whenever they had accomplishments, but, like, I would get these accomplishments as well. And it was just kind of like, good job. It was so frustrating. I felt so sad because I felt like I was doing something wrong, you know? And I graduated top 10 of my class. I got so many awards and scholarships and I was being recognized, like, pretty much statewide, you know? And that, I don't know, the look of, like, just, like, it's not disappointment. It's almost like, oh, good job. You know, like, it's like a kind of snide. And I felt like that's the reaction I got from my mom, you know, but, like, my younger sister or my older sister would get, like, decent grades or some kind of recognition. And she's just like, oh, you guys did so well. And I'm just like, still here. Can I get some of that too, please?
So at this point of your life, you have now, like, a group of friends.
Yes.
Are you able to recognize that what happens in your home versus what happens in someone else's home is different, because now you actually have a frame of reference to figure out what you're dealing with is not normal?
Yeah. And I think that's why my mom hated us hanging out with our friends or doing, like, too much extracurricular activities. It was always go to school, go home. And when you're at the house, you know, like, we just played around the house. Like, we were very, like, sheltered children. And I think my mom did that because she was like, if these girls go out and they see what life is like outside of this, they're going to realize that, like, this is not the way it should be, you know? And I realized that, unfortunately for my sisters who, you know, they also had their experiences of friends outside of the house, but they were still very tightly tied to my mom. Whereas, like, for me, I was able to step back and be like, whoa, this is, like, very different, you know? And I rationalize it at first as like, oh, well, we're Asian and my friends are, like, you know, white and black and everything else. So it was like, maybe it's a cultural difference. And that's why, like, they're so much more, like, chill, whereas my family's more uptight. So, like, I mean, for a very long time, I just thought it was, like, a cultural thing, not that, like, it's, like, a toxic thing in the family itself, you know?
Well, I'm sure for a lot of people out there, they've gone throughout their lives thinking it's a cult, like, the way I grew up is a cultural difference. That's what you're always told. It's a cultural difference. And then eventually you might figure out, because there's no frame of reference of other people that are in the same culture as well, that no, this is not a culture thing. I'm told it's a culture thing, but it's really toxic behavior. And yeah. with your mom here, I'm going to bring up the word control.
Mm-hmm.
And your mom spent a lot of her life trying to get away from control. And then doesn't have the vision or the internal awareness that she's repeating the mm-hmm. same things that were done to her, which has to be frustrating. Are you able at that age to actually say, like, out loud or inside your head, like, hey, like, you did that and you were, you know, you were explaining this to us in this way and now you're doing it to us? Did you see a hypocrisy of what was going on?
I saw it when I was around 18. And that was like my first crack in the relationship with my mom as well, where she had this no dating rule. It was like, you're not allowed to date till you graduate high school. And it was 3 months before my high school graduation. And I met this boy that I thought was cute and sweet. Biggest douche canoe ever. BT Doves. Did not last. But I challenged the no dating rule. And I was like, Mom, I would like to date this guy. And she said, it's 3 months from graduation. Like, you're not allowed to date. I'm like, well, why not? What were the stipulations of why we're not allowed to date? And if she just said, because I said so, that'd be one thing. But she rationalized it by saying, you girls made a promise to me that if I stayed with your dad, you wouldn't date until you graduated high school. And so I said, now at the time, one, making a verbal contract with a minor for something like that is like totally unethical, probably illegal. But the other thing was that, like, I told my mom, I was like, well, you and dad divorced for 6 years at this point. Doesn't that mean that that verbal contract is no longer like valid? You know, I was just like, well, you're not with dad anymore, so why can't I date? And she got really upset because I think that was the first time one of us ever like challenged her logic or challenged her authority in any way. And she got like super pissed at me. And I've never like seen my mom like angry at me for a thing before. And I was just like, Mom, do you want me to date this boy before I go off to college where you can like teach me the right ways and what I need to be prepared for? Or do you want me to not date until I graduate high school, go off to college, fuck around, and then come home 3 months later pregnant with an STD? Like you can decide if you want to educate me or if you want me to just go into the wild and figure it out.
So the rebel in you came to light here. The person that you really are,
yeah,
came to light here. And how does your mom respond to that? Because this is someone they've never seen before, the real you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think she always hinted, like she always saw it, that I was different from my sisters. And she knew that whatever control she had over my sisters, it was going to be harder to do with me. I could see the anger at first, and then I could see now that like she was afraid of losing that control over me, and that this was like the first moment where my mom had to be like, I need to control her or I need to get her out. So she allowed me to date this boy anyway. And I dated him for 6 months, you know, through high school graduation and then into my first semester of college when I broke it off with him. He calls my mom crying that I broke up with him. So my mom calls me yelling. And like, this is my first semester of college. I had just turned 19 and my birthday has just passed. And it was my first time long-term away from home, from having nothing but my family to like now not having them or a boyfriend or anything. And my mom was like, I let you date this boy and you break up with him only after 6 months. And I got really upset because then again, my logic clicked in and I was just like, mom, how long would have I had to date this guy before it was okay that I broke up with him? And she got so pissed at me. And she said, oh, so you think you're so responsible now? And I said, no, mom, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not responsible. I don't have a job. I don't know how to like handle my money. I just started college, you know? I said, I'm not a responsible person, but I should have autonomy over who I choose to be in a relationship with. And she didn't like that. She didn't like that I had that logic. And she got pissed off and said, well, if you think you're so responsible now, don't bother calling home. Don't come home. We don't want you here. And then she hung up. And that was the first time that I got disowned in my life. Under all the other circumstances, you know, I had just like broken up with my first boyfriend and I lost, you know, that. And then indirectly my family as well. And now I was like, I am really alone. And I was terrified.
So you're sitting there and you're terrified. Where do you go? Who do you call? Like, what do you latch on to find your footing here? And what in your mind, like, obviously your mind can take you to some strange places when you're in these moments. What were you thinking at that point your life was going to turn out like, if that makes sense?
I've always been a get shit done kind of girl. And for me, that's kind of been my entire life. It's like, oh, you don't have a family anymore. Well, you need to learn how to open a bank account, get your own P.O. box or whatever. And you need to know how to like figure out your finances, see if you can get a job. Like I had to figure out all of those logistics very quickly, even though like I've had no experience in any of that before. And for me, it's just like, I'm just not the person to lay down and die. I'm not the type of person who just curls up and hopes that it gets better in the morning. No, I'm like, I need to do this or I will die. And I refuse to die. I'm stubbornly the type of person who refuses to die in many occasions. With this as well, it was just like, I don't have my mom, but I have me. And that's what matters right now. And like, if I can't depend on myself, what am I going to do? So I had to like just get my shit together and do that. And then of course, like I had to learn how to make friends outside of like, you know, my family circle. A lot of high school friends don't go to the same colleges that you do either. So like, you know, we all got separated in that way as well. And life goes on. But like for me, I was like, I don't know if I'm ever going to have my family back, but I need to make sure that I make it out of this alive. And so I just got my shit together and just did the best I could.
I think what is interesting, or maybe I'm wrong, is that you stayed on your side as far as a boundary went. You didn't try and go to get into the good graces. You had a real stiff boundary right here where you're like, I'm going to go concentrate on me and I'm not going to try and concentrate on whatever is going on in that household with my sisters, with my step siblings, which we really haven't touched on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With anybody at all. I'm concentrating on me and my future.
Right.
And I think that's really interesting because a lot of people who are looking for the approval of their parents, a big tough thing would be to say to themselves, I'm putting a line in the sand right here.
Right.
I'm not jumping back over that line. Mm. And you didn't want anything to do with that. You're waiting for, I guess, if anything, we'll find out more, them maybe to come back to you, or
yeah,
that door to be opened. And you weren't, you, you got good boundaries at this point.
Yeah. Just gets more solid from there. But
One thing that we didn't mention with that, which I just mentioned, which was other siblings that haven't been mentioned before. Was that really confusing? So explain one specific sibling that eventually did enter your family, how that all happened, because they become a player in this story.
Yeah, sure. So my cousin, actually, on my mom's side, my mom adopted him after Hurricane Katrina, because his parents couldn't really or didn't really want to take care of him. I don't know. Like, I think, like, because my cousin's mom was a teen mom. They were teenagers when they had him. So I think, like, they really just wanted to offload that responsibility and live their lives. And my mom just decided to take guardianship. So he's, like, legally my adopted brother now, which is awesome. And he's been in our family ever since. He's about the same age as number three. I think they're both like 25-ish now, but yeah. And then my half siblings, 4 and 5, are from my stepdad. Five is my half sister. 6 is my half brother. And right now, I think the age range, my youngest sibling is like 13 or 14. And my oldest sister is like 32-ish. And so, like, there's like a major age gap with like all of us. And unfortunately, when I left for college at 19, 5 and 6 were very young. They were like 3 and 4 years old. So they pretty much grew up without me. Number three and four were in high school, I think, at the time, but they were still very impressionable. So my mom and my older sister's influence, you know, definitely like changed their perspective of me to some extent.
How does it feel to be universally disliked by the family?
It doesn't feel real. It feels like I've done something wrong. And all I was trying to do was be myself and take responsibility for my own actions and be independent. And for them, it's such a beehive mentality, you know, where it's like, it's us against the world. And if you're not with us, then you're with all the other evil people. And for them, they realize that they can't control me. Especially now that, like, I'm off in college and I've, you know, made these decisions for myself, you know, they can't control me. So they need to change the narrative, or else they're going to lose, control of everybody else in their family.
And this is why families are on the cult spectrum.
They are. It is such a cult. It's so bad. It's the amount of deprogramming that would take to clean everybody in the family. Like, it would just be too exhausting. That could be someone's entire career. But it's the fact that I was able to realize that so early on in my life and was able to pull away from it. It got to a point, and now more especially, my peace of mind was more important than my need for my family. And that became more and more true the older I got. And like, my mom did take me back for a while, but like it was with conditions, you know? And at that point, after the first disownment, she and my older sister tend to triangulate me a lot, where, you know, when I did, the few times that I did come home to visit or we were on the phone or whatever with each other, anything that they don't like that I did, they both like went against me. at the same time. And because, you know, I'm there by myself, I'm already in a household that like doesn't really give a shit about me, I was very vulnerable to those attacks, you know? And I don't know, like it felt so helpless because they make me feel so shitty for just like trying to figure out who I am, trying to do this and whatever. And it just wasn't something that I was aware that was bad for me. Because for me, I was like, oh, I'm the bad thing. I'm doing all the things that I want to do, but at the cost of like really upsetting my family and disappointing my family. And so like, I mean, I was still doing what I wanted to do, but it came with so much guilt, which had no foundation at all. Like they made me feel guilty for making friends and dating and just like being a teenager.
And then eventually your mom wants to control who you marry.
Yes, abso-fucking-lutely she did. So I was 19, maybe had just turned 20 at the time, but I was so desperate to get back in my mom's good graces. Like I was still like trying to hold strong and be my own person, but extend my love to her in any way that I could. And she came to me with this proposition to marry her nephew in Vietnam to bring him to America. My cousin, my first cousin, actually, she said that she loved him and she wanted him to have a better life in America. So number one actually volunteered to marry him because she has this high ideal of honor and loyalty to the family. And she was like, I can bear this weight if it means that, like, you know, it's I'm seen as like a strong person, someone who's like really caring and would sacrifice her own like marital status for, you know, a family member or whatever. But she didn't have a job. And apparently you need some kind of an income to be able to sponsor a spouse from out of the country. I mean, I worked in retail, which like doesn't pay much for one person, but my mom said that she was going to like fund the rest of the marriage to get him over here. All I had to do was sign my name.
So with things like adopting your cousin and mm-hmm. you know, taking in a different cousin to get him married off to you as a way to get them over here, is your mom's, I guess, psyche here looking for approval from the rest of the family as of like, what a good person I am. Look what I'm doing for the family. Like kind of like she's still part of this hive mentality.
Yeah.
She has her own hive connected to this hive where she's the queen bee of that hive. But in reality, maybe one day she's working her way through to get the other queen or whoever that is, the approval that she desperately wants or needs.
Right.
And then maybe one day can take over the whole entire hive.
It's so bizarre because like, it just feels like their kindness comes with a motive. Like they don't do kind things for goodness sake. They do it because of how people will view them, how people will like see them, and she loves the admiration, she loves the sympathy, you know. And I mean, it's addicting, you know, that kind of like affirmation, validation from people. I don't like it's so bad only to me because I feel like she purposely takes in broken people to try. It's very culty, guys. Broken people are very vulnerable to this type of mentality where it's like, hey, let me help you. And in return, you know, We are like your God. Like we are your saviors. And we could do no wrong. So anyone who wrongs us, you need to hate them too. Like kind of thing. Like she that's how she builds her little army of people. And like, it's so weird. Like the fact that they do these good things only so that they can brag about, or not even brag, but like showcase it, you know? It's just like, oh, well, if I do this kind thing, this is how it'll look to me or on about me, you know? And for me, it makes me question the good things that I do for other people as well, because I worry, you know, with that imposter syndrome that, like, am I doing good things for people just like my mom and sister are, because they want that recognition, they want that sympathy? And for me, it's very different. I'm just like, no, like I want one less person to feel lonely. I want one less person to feel helpless and all that stuff. And for me, if I can make a person's day or life better, that's all the incentive that I need, you know. And I question that all the time because of my mom and sister.
And here you are being given the opportunity to change your cousin's life in Vietnam. So how do you deal with that when you're given the arranged marriage proposal?
I took it so fast because I was like, this is what's going to get my mom to love me again. 19-year-old minds, guys, we do reckless shit. But I agreed to it very quickly. And we went through the whole process, pretty close to the whole process. You know, we had to go, had to go back to Vietnam, which now I'm really hating going to Vietnam because both times were not for me. I had to go back there. We had to like take pictures with my cousin in like, you know, just lovey-dovey positions, and we had to do the paperwork and just basically make it look like it's a legit relationship, and that we were really wanting to go forward with it. And that was when my first signs of severe anxiety and depression really hit. I think I've always like had like hints of it as a kid, the anxiety for sure, but it really hit hard when I was in that engagement process, because like I felt like what I was doing felt wrong, and that it didn't feel like I was gaining anything out of it except for my mom's approval, and it still felt like it wasn't enough. And I couldn't tell anyone in my side of the family, because who would empathize with me? Who would understand that, you know? I would often be called selfish if I did things for me. And I was like, this is the first like selfless thing I think that I've done for them. And like, if I just stick this out, then my mom would love me again. Like she loves my siblings. And I don't want to say that like, she never loved me the way she loved them, but at that point, I don't think she could have loved me as much as she loved my siblings. And to this day, that still holds true. And I still cry about that shit, especially during holidays. I'm just like, why doesn't my mom love me like she loves my siblings? But it's something that I have to like deal with internally all the time. And it sucked. I was crying. I think I cut myself once. And then realized I hated the feeling, so I didn't do it again. So I don't encourage it for anybody, but especially for me, I was like, oh, I don't like this pain. So I chose not to do it again. So all of my pain happened internally. I never projected it onto my body or anybody else in that way. But it, yeah, dude, this arranged marriage, like, fucked me up so much. And I was still dating people, and I had to like hide my relationship with these guys so that I couldn't publicize my relationship with like my actual boyfriends, because like if, you know, people in social media saw that, then they'll be like, oh, well, then your arranged marriage is a sham, you know? And so I had to keep all of my relationships in secret. And my mom actually randomly called off the wedding one day, because my cousin was posting pictures of him and his girlfriend on social media. And so like she got super upset with him. She was like, I'm doing all of this to bring you to America, and you're just like publicizing your relationship with like your actual girlfriend and all that stuff. And so she got pissed at him and she called it off. And at this time I had started dating my husband. And again, I had to keep it a secret, but my mom called it off, and I was like asking for her blessing to publicize my relationship with my husband. And she gave me the blessing. She was like, yeah, fine, whatever, just do that. So like, I felt like without having to do anything, I was free from that burden, you know, and it felt so good.
Did she do that out of spite to your cousin? Who?
Yeah, absolutely.
She's like, I tried to help you. I'm not doing this to help my daughter here. I just want to spite you so you know that this whole entire thing we were doing is over.
Yep, yep. And months later, she calls me and said she went back to Vietnam by herself. She reconciled with my cousin, and I was just like, congratulations, that's awesome. And then she drops the bomb of, I need you to do this arranged marriage again. Bruh, my heart sank into my gut. I felt like my whole world was like spiraling again, because I was immediately brought back to all of those triggers of like, I have to go through that psychological torture of like, am I doing the right thing, or am I just like doing the thing for a love that I'm never going to achieve? Like, there was just so many things going on in my head, and I froze for like the first time in my life. I was shattered, and I made the decision for the second time in my life to say no. And I, at first I was like, can I think about this or whatever? And then, I went to work that night. I was working as a server at a restaurant. It was super busy. And she calls me in the middle of my shift. And she's like, can you do this for me? Like, please do this for me. And like, in an Asian culture, when someone who's older than you is telling you that they're on their knees and they're begging you or whatever, it's a big sign of disrespect. Because like, older people should not have to lower themselves to a younger person, you know? And so my mom used that, and she said, Henrietta, please do this for me. I love my nephew. I want him to have a better life. Don't you love him too? If you love me, you would do this. And she said, I'm on my knees. I'm begging you. And I was crying, because all I wanted to do was yell at her. Like, you don't understand how much this hurt me, you know, but I couldn't. And all I could choke up was, I'm sorry, mom, I can't. And just over and over, that was all I could say. And like, after like a few of those, she realized that like, she's not going to get through to me. So she just like hung up on me and then disowned me for the second time. And like, honestly, dude, show me the meaning of being lonely. Cause that was that moment. I was crying my eyes out in this restaurant. I had once again lost my entire family over something so dumb, and I had to like wipe the tears away, go back on the floor and get shit done. Like, people still had to get served, you know? And for me, I was broken again. Like, I lost my mom again, but at least this time I have my husband with me. Who like, you know, he was what saved me, honestly, you know, throughout all of this.
So now you're with your husband, And what is he saying to you about this situation? And he's obviously learning all about your life. How does he come into play and reinforcing you as a person? And then also at the same time, how do you not, how do you keep good boundaries with him during this process and not putting your worth in all of what you want from your mom and everything into him?
That's hard. And that's still a lesson I've had to learn 10 years in the future. Like that took 10 years for me to fully realize that. But my husband, he just, when he walks into a room, he brings this like aura of Zen into the room, and everyone just like kind of immediately like calms. So I'm very hyperactive. I'm very high energy. I'm, I gotta go, go, go. And he is just like very chill, very laid back. And he was able to calm me down, help me process the pain and rationalize why my family is doing what they're doing. Like, he gave me so much clarity about just how fucked up the situation is. He was like, you realize your family's toxic, right? And he was like, your mom shouldn't. And I was just like, my husband's biased because, you know, he's with me or whatever. But like, that's not the case at all. Like, apparently, like he was very honest about it. He was like, that's not healthy for you. Like, he was like, you're doing so much to get their approval and you know you're not going to get it. So why do you continue to put yourself through that pain, you know? And he mellowed me out a lot. He helped me with my anger issues. He helped me better process, you know, the dynamic between me and my mom and my siblings even, you know? And I was able to really step back and not see my family as like all good, all bad. I'm just like, they're just very like broken people and they're just doing the best that they can to survive, you know, and this is what worked so far for them. And this is what they're going to continue to do. And I just refuse to be a part of that.
So you're now in this situation where you're boyfriend or your husband now is involved in your life and you have to go no contact. So what were the steps of going no contact or the gradual no contact?
Yeah. So it was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be only because they had gray rocked me for so long. They gray rocked me, you know, like I would try to reach out. I would try to like, you know, try to bond with my siblings, but they've already solidified this mindset that I'm a bad person and that like spending time with me isn't worth it. So they've kind of just seen me as like a distant relative or a guest who come to the house. So that was already in the works. So that was gradual. My older sister and I cut her off and it ended in quite the argument. And I was just like, she does this thing where she'll do the nice thing for me and say, we do this because we're siblings. Like, you don't owe me anything, you know, like this is just what we do. And then like the next time we get upset with each other, anytime after that, we get upset with each other, she'll bring it up. Well, I did this for you and I did that for you. I was there for you when you and your boyfriend got into an argument. I gave you money when you were this and that or whatever. And at some point I was just like, I can't do this with you anymore. I was just like, you're toxic and I don't need this in my life. And it's like, you're my sister, but I don't have to treat you the way that all the other siblings treat you because I'm not being respected at all. And so I was like, I'm going to pay you back all the money that I owe you. Don't call me. Don't come to my workplace. Don't follow me to my apartment. And I was serious. I was just like, I will call the cops on you if you like overstep that boundary. And she immediately, when I blocked her, she immediately called number four, the adopted brother, because the catalyst of that argument revolved around him. And she called him and said, before Henrietta calls you, this is what happened. She blew it out of proportion. And like, she spun her narrative. And I didn't even think to call number four, because I was just like, that's an argument between me and number one. Like, four is not involved. So four calls me and he was just like, hey, is this true or whatever? And I was like, why don't you come over to my apartment one day and I will read verbatim the chat message that I had with number one. And when I think like a few days after that, you know, he came over and I read the text messages verbatim that revolved him and all that stuff. And he said, that's not at all what number one said. I was like, I'm not telling you to make up your mind. I'm telling you, this is what was said. You can make up your own mind. You know, like it's, and that's kind of how it's always been. They'll spin and they'll make sure that their narrative is set in stone before I get a word in, so that people already have an idea of what the story is, you know? So there's no room for me to defend myself, because no one even cares at that point. She's just trying to get like sympathy or us on her side. And I told my brother, I was just like, yo, like, these are the messages. You can decide for yourself, like, what you feel about the situation, you know? And that was, like, one of the reasons why, like, Four and I get along so well, is because, like, I don't bullshit him the way that my family does, you know? And I was very real with our dynamic. I was like, I'm your older sister, but you are an adult now. I will allow you to have, you know, your freedom as an adult. If you need me, I'm here. But for me, I'm just like, I had to learn how to be an adult by myself. I don't want to coddle you throughout your entire life like everybody else in the family has. So get on your own 2 feet, do your own shit. I am here if you need me to catch you.
Has that been healing for you, that relationship?
Yeah. He's the only member in my family, like in my immediate family, who I still talk to. It just felt so good to have at least one person on my side. He was still like, he still talks to my family and all that. Like he's in their circle, but, because he kind of sort of followed in my footsteps, he was able to step away from that and see the dynamic between everyone and see how toxic it is and how little control we have, you know? But he's just like, they're my peeps. Y'all took me in when my family, my own parents wouldn't. Like, so he's like devoted to them, you know, and he loves the younger siblings for sure. And he's very aware of like the toxicity with my mom and my older sister, but he learns to let that ride. And for me, I learned to remove myself from it.
But he knows always that you're the one that got out, and that if he ever needs that last step of getting out, that you are this refuge, at least for an ear, which must be nice, because after everything that's happened with your mom, with your older sister, just the whole entire family as a whole, to at least know, and not everyone can deal with this the way you are, in the sense of, you know, a lot of people are just don't speak to any member of their family anymore. And it becomes a big thing, but it really must be nice to know that like you can be there for this specific family member when they mm-hmm. need you. And that there mm-hmm. is that little still bit of a connection that might give mm-hmm. you like a warmth that you need. So I'm happy that you have that.
Yeah. And, with my other siblings, you know, like I cut off contact with my mom, August of 2020. So like in the midst of the beginning of the pandemic, yeah, for the last like year and a half, August will be 2 years now, I haven't talked to my mom. And because of that, unfortunately, I had to go no contact with the rest of my mom's side of the family too, because everything I said to them went back to my mom and older sister. And it was used as ammo for them to like gossip about me. And I was like, I can't try to spend quality time with you only for you to weaponize that as gossip. And I had to step away from that too. And I was just like, I need to learn how to be at peace on my own without anybody's help, you know? And I mean, thank God I had my husband, who he just keeps me grounded, you know, like he's like a real life guru. Like he's so grounded in that way. And he helped me like get so far. And so transitioning out of that family was a lot healthier and a lot better for me in the long run.
So if you had any words of wisdom for others that are in these family relationships and relationships as a whole, what words of wisdom or advice do you have for them?
Even if you feel like you have lost everything and everyone, you still have you. And I feel like a lot of people forget that. You don't need, I'm not saying you don't need to depend on people, but there is not a life-threatening necessity to stay with people who hurt you. There's no need to get closure from people like that either. I feel like people want to reconcile and want to have that closure, and you don't need that. Why do you need someone who hurt you to tell you that they hurt you and that they're sorry? Like, I mean, one, are they even really sorry? And two, do you need that from them? Like, you've done fine healing yourself. You are capable. You are able to do everything that they say you can't do. That doesn't make you selfish, you know? It makes you resilient to be able to shatter that perspective that they are your end-all be-all. They are your only lifeline. They are not. You are your lifeline. You have that choice. And you can't, don't give up on yourself because of it, you know? And I tell people, it was like, in love and death, expect nothing, hope for more. And that goes with like your relationships with these abusers or anybody in your life. And like in death, it's, you don't know what happens after death. We have an idea, we have hopes and all that stuff, but you know, you have this life. You are living it right now. You are alive right now. Do what you can with this life and do something for yourself. If you crap out at 80 and you don't know what the afterlife is or reincarnation is, do you want to live your whole life knowing that you were trying to please people who were never going to approve of you, who were never going to love you or accept you? You know, and for me, I couldn't do that to myself anymore. I had to walk away, and I was like, they might see it as selfish, but I am living my life for me. And I hadn't done that in so long, like, especially at the beginning of my life, you know? And yeah, that's kind of what I have to say with that.
Well, Henrietta, I want to thank you for being our guest today and sharing your story, sharing, you know, your pain. All of you had a lot of learning lessons in there, so I really want to thank you. And so, but before we end off, I'm going to share a Backstreet Boys factoid with you.
Are you really? Oh, this is great. I'm ready.
It's my own factoid, and it's something a lot of people don't really know, but in 1996, I lived in Montreal. And I don't know if you know this, but the Backstreet Boys fandom pretty much began in Montreal or in Quebec, Canada. I think that's where like they grew out from, like their first stronghold of like fans kind of came from there. I was one day walking down the street, St. Catherine Street, in front of, I was going past HMV, which is a music store, or was a music store at the time. And it was crazy. It was mobbed. And there was just girls everywhere. They just surrounded this place. And mm-hmm. I remember asking someone, I'm like, who's here? I was 20 years old. I'm like, who's here?
Right.
They're like, the Backstreet Boys. And I was like, I don't know who that is. But I guess who was in charge, I think like maybe a month later, the rest of the world began to know who they were.
Yeah.
But I think the marketing strategy or whatever, like for bands like this, they start off in like one little pocket. Mm-hmm. And like they grow their fandom from there. So like they know they have this stronghold to always go back to, and then they
right.
grow from there. And
yeah.
it was, for some reason, it was in Quebec. Or at least I think it was because of what was going on. But I really do think that's what kind of happened. That's where they started their like the groundswell of what was going on
that's
for
awesome.
Them.
That's so, a great fact.
So if there was a song that you want to sing us out with, go for it.
Absolutely not. I will not humiliate myself. I'm like, good try though. It's
I
been
try.
2 hours and you've tried. You really did.
Well, Henrietta, once again, I really want to thank you for being here. You were able to just touch a lot of people today in sharing your story, and you're going to help a lot of people. So big thank you from me and everyone out there.
Thank you so much for having me. I really hope my story can help even one person. I'm rooting for all of y'all, really. Like it feels like it's so scary and so lonely, but I mean, y'all are tough cookies. You've gotten this far, you know. Don't doubt yourself. Don't allow people to put doubt in you and make you feel worthless, because you know you're not. At your core, you are not a worthless being. So don't treat yourself like that.
Well, thank you for those words. And if you want to be a guest like Henrietta was today, please do go to narcissistapocalypse.com. Top of the page, there's a button that says guest form. When you click on that button, it takes you to our guest form page. There's all the instructions there. Please read the instructions and send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com, or just submit it through our guest form page. Also at our website at narcissistapocalypse.com, we have our very own safe social network. So at the top of the page, there's a button that says support group. When you click on that, it takes you to our support group page. There we have our very own forum boards. Took me a while to spit that out. Our forum boards are there for you to ask questions, get support there. We have Zoom meetings every Wednesday night and Saturday night and every other Thursday afternoon. We have episodes that never made it to air. We have ad-free episodes as well. And if you just want to support our show, just join our support group, because it helps us out a lot. And if you need even more support, please do go visit our friends at domesticshelters.org. And domesticshelters.org has articles and resources to help you make sense of what you're going through. They have local resources like shelters. They can connect you with them. And it's just a great organization, a great place. It's a free resource. You can access everything at domesticshelters.org. So once again, a big thank you to everyone for listening, and to Henrietta, and from myself and Henrietta, we hope you have a good night.